you may have seen, is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? Nope. No, sir. Not today. No actors. Not doing it. Not this time, pal. We're stepping out of the box a little today. Going outside the comfort zone. A little. Not a lot, but a little. I'm going into the fast and crazy world of rock and roll. That's right, baby. Today I'm talking with David Palmer, former frontman for Steely Dan. What? I know. Crazy, right? I'm like the luckiest guy in the world. We talk life as a rock and roller in the 70s, collaborating with the one and only Carole King, and how that journey has led him to his current life as a photo artist. Oh, and this song right here that you're listening to? It's him. It's one of his. It's one of his originals. I don't understand my life sometimes. It's the coolest thing. Here we go. I don't know if you've listened to any of the podcasts before.
Of course, Julius.
Yeah, great. There you go. The most important one. So, you know.
House.
So, obviously, this is, you know, this is different. Like, I'm going, like, out of my comfort zone because you're not an actor.
No.
Are you an actor?
No.
Nothing.
No one's ever accused. Well, people have accused me of it, but no, I'm not. Not officially, no. I was in SAG.
But were you really?
For different reasons, yeah.
Okay, you've got me now. What were those reasons?
When you were a singer.
Okay.
For movies.
Oh.
You couldn't just be an after member. You had to join SAG.
Okay. Now, did you have to be an after member to do the TV shows?
I am not sure how that works anymore, but I knew I had to join SAG. I sang on a couple of movie titles.
Right.
And in order for me to do that, they had to get me. Now, in the union, I don't think I was grandfathered in. I cannot remember how it worked. But it was, SAG was lucrative and AFTRA was never lucrative.
Oh, no, right. No one cared about being a member
of AFTRA. They should pay you to join. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I have retirement from AFTRA. I make $130 a month.
There you go.
Out of my pension.
And I never thought about that. Was there any stipulation about like doing the variety shows or the talk shows when you guys...
That was the problem, but I think that in order to do a movie title or to be in any kind of theatrical release, you had to be in SAG.
Hmm. All right, so I'm going out on a limb here. I'm going from film and television into the music business and beyond. So, David Palmer, where may we have seen you? Or heard you, even? Whatever.
Various radio stations around the nation. Seen me? Not a whole lot. unless it was, post office wall or something.
There you go.
Ba-dum-ba.
There you go.
No, I didn't do a lot of visuals, but it was basically, if you had a radio back in the 70s, you probably heard me.
Oh my God, I love it. Radio in the 70s. I'm already going back. Be a little more specific.
Okay.
I mean, of course, I'm going to fill in the blanks anyway, but I'm going to give you the chance to to talk about
how specific. You mean what?
However specific you want to be.
Well, I came out of New Jersey. I was born and raised in New Jersey.
Oh yeah. First of all, how are you enjoying these rough southern winters? How are you liking Snowmageddon today?
Yeah, it's just overpowering. It's such a much ado about absolutely nothing.
You know, the kids are getting out of school today.
As I was coming over here, I saw a school bus parked and they were leaving. And I was like, what is going on?
Right.
You know, there's for those of your listeners, it's raining today and they're expecting snow.
Right,
but
right.
It's a big deal here. No, I born and raised in New Jersey. We used to have blizzards. That was, that I get.
Right.
And I went to school in Boston, so it was even worse.
Yeah, I'm from Rhode Island, so I mean, exactly.
New Englanders go, oh, what is this?
This
is a joke.
It's a spring.
You know.
All right, so anyway, continuing. Yes, where were you heard, seen, listened to on the radio?
Okay, I was a member of the original Steely Dan.
Yes.
I sang I'm a Fool to Do Your Dirty Work.
Great song.
From the first album, mm-hmm. and also a song called Brooklyn on the first album, and backgrounds on a lot of the rest of it. So that was my claim to fame, the first album. And then 2 years after that, mm-hmm. I wrote a song called Jazz Man with Carole King. So that was also basically where you would have heard me at the time.
A pretty sizable success.
Yeah, the 70s were very good to me. I wish I had been there for them, as they used to say. The 60s and the 70s are sort of a blank. But
I definitely want to talk to you more about that.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was a great time. And then, I mean, I kept in the music business for a long time.
Right.
Long past my expiration date, as I used to say. It's funny because there's a guy coming to Middle Sieg Jazz Club here in March, a guy named Steve Tyrell.
Okay.
Steve's an old friend, and he's also was my last employer as a writer,
really?
Songwriter. Yeah.
You checked out that club yet?
I haven't been there, but I'm waiting for. I have tickets for Steve. Yeah. We'll go see Steve. But it's funny because that was my last gig, and it had to be sometime in the 90s or something.
Wow.
Maybe. I kept writing, and I kept doing that, and I kept getting publishing deals, and that kept going, but no real huge success after that. I had played, you know, songs got placed and stuff, but that was the 70s, and it is so bizarre because that stuff is still around.
Right.
I mean, Steely's, you know, sort of, a, you know, the iconic
of course.
Band, so their stuff still sells, and Carol's does too. It's
sure.
It's an annuity for me, and as I was telling my girlfriend the other day, and for you when I'm no longer with us.
Right, right.
I had a really good run, and I'm very grateful for it. And I was not appreciative of it when it was happening, so I'm very appreciative now.
So did you end up in the bigger picture do more writing than you did singing?
Yeah, at the end, yeah. I kept making demos, and I kept getting deals on the basis of those demos. But it's funny, if somebody asked me, are you still singing? And no, I'm not. I lost the desire to do it. It became such a business to me that the art of it was gone. And that was me. You know, there are a lot of great musicians still around. It's so funny. Michael McDonald's a friend. And
awesome.
Yeah, and a good friend. And it's funny. We're not close, but he sort of replaced me in the Dan, which was...
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Not as a member, but he was singing on the albums after me, pretty much. He was the other guy you would hear sing besides Donald. So I ran into him about a year and a half ago, and we started to talk. He's coming to Charlotte, too, with the Doobies. I mean, they reformed.
Oh, wow.
It's a big reunion tour. Man. I don't even know when that is. I think it's this summer, but I'm not positive. But anyway, we were talking about the business, and he said, there's no business. He said, it's gone, you know, and music business.
Right.
Steve said the same thing. I said, how's the music business? He said, there's what business? It changed so vastly. And in a way, it's a good thing.
Okay.
Because artists started to get their true worth.
Okay.
You know, as opposed to having to pay the record company and who did nothing and you got a 10% royalty or 5% or whatever. I saw the change happening. You know, when I came up, that was not heard of.
Yeah.
You know, you signed to a company for a big deal, whether it be CBS or, and that wasn't CBS, but it was Columbia or in my case, ABC. It didn't matter. You signed to a company and you signed your life away, basically.
Really?
I mean, if you were successful, it continued. Your royalties continued and my royalties have continued. But for new artists, it's a whole different scene. And I respect them because they're out there promoting themselves.
Right.
But they're getting promoting their tours and doing everything themselves, which is a very different business than I came up in.
Now, you're attributing it to the change to this whole digital technological changeover.
I think it is. Absolutely. The industry was not prepared for what was going to happen. And consequently, they lost, you know, everything was being stolen and taken and the copyrights. It was like a nightmare. I was very fortunate again, but a lot of people didn't get so fortunate.
Let's go back to the top here a little bit. How much of your Wikipedia page is true? How much of this is true?
You know what?
Are you even aware?
I have not looked at that page in a long time.
All right.
I think what's true is that I did become a photographer and I did become an artist. And the rest of it's up for grabs.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna go through just the top of it to see, and you can correct things as we go along. Okay, it says his first band was The Middle Class, formed in 1964 under the initial name The King Bees, while members were still in high school.
Yes.
As The Middle Class, the band performed at such clubs as The Night Owl in Greenwich Village and released several 45s. How does it feel to hear that? 45s. I mean, I had 45s.
What are these 45s of which you speak, my
friend? I'm wondering how many people would be listening going, what the hell's a 45? When's the last time you saw a 45?
As a matter of fact, I think I have a few laying around the house someplace, and I don't know if I can, but yes, it's been a while.
Right.
Well, I haven't read that page in a long time, but the truth is what happened was King Bees was a band, and because we loved the Stones.
Right.
And we loved all that stuff, all that kind of rhythm and blues, so that we were trying to emulate that.
Right.
Somewhere along the line, we came under the scrutiny. We did. I know exactly what happened. We did a talent show at a high school. One of us was a member of that high school, and the people went crazy. It was like Beatlemania kind of stuff.
Right.
I don't know how that happened, by the way, but it was amazing. And there was a writer named Al Aronowitz. Okay. Al Aronowitz was the pop writer for the New York Post, and at the time, I think the Star Ledger in Newark.
Okay.
And he was a big pop guy. And right. he had written a great article for the Saturday Evening Post called The Dumb Sound. And it was about Phil Spector and that all that those 50s, 60s guys, 50s mm-hmm. basically, who had invented this new rock and roll sound, Carole King being one of them.
Wow.
And Jerry Goffin being one of them. Yeah. You know, they had invented that new kind of Broadway mm-hmm. R&B sound. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he's a great writer, and he found us, and he discovered us, and he said, I want to manage you guys. Now, he was the guy who introduced, it's a very long story, but he introduced Bob Dylan to the Beatles.
Okay.
Back in the day.
Wow.
And so he had yeah. that, you know, he had that cred. And he said, I know these two writers. They're looking for a band to produce. And we said, well, okay, great, you know. And he introduced us to Jerry Goffin and Carole King.
Oh, my God.
And Carole King, now I was 18, so Carole had to be 23, 24. God. And she and Jerry, her husband, yep. started to produce us. And all those 40, and I got a deal with Atlantic uh-huh. Records, and those records came out with them. So that's how I got to meet Carole and
wow.
know Carole.
Wow. So that relationship goes way back.
Back. 66, wow. 60, 1965, something like that.
Wow.
So yes, that goes way back.
Now, it says that the you guys disbanded in 1969?
Yeah.
And that you next formed, I'm going to try and say this right,
Quinames.
Quinames Band?
Quinames Band. I in the intervening years, because of the draft.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was called, and I had some physical problems, so I wasn't called up.
Okay.
The rest of us were scared to death that we were going to have to go to Vietnam. So most of us ended up going to college. I went okay. to Emerson College in Boston.
There you go. Colleen went to Emerson.
Yeah. I went to Emerson when it was... didn't own Boston. It's right. since taken over the entire city.
Yeah.
When I went, it was a small liberal arts college.
Right.
It was during the 60s and 60s, so you can imagine a lot of protesting and craziness going on behind the war. And I went to this little college, this little liberal arts college, to and went there because my guitar player mm-hmm. had been in the middle class, a great guitar player, was going there, and we wanted to continue to write.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of my freshman year, he was murdered. By his roommate.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it was a terrible, you know, one of the defining moments in my life.
Wow.
And he lost his life, and I was at loose ends, and I got a call somehow from New York. I was going to school, but I hated it. I didn't, you know, it's like a fish out of water. I did not belong there. But I got a call, and somebody was putting a band together, and mm-hmm. they said, do you want to get involved in this? I said, sure. So we put a band together on Martha's Vineyard.
Okay.
When you could actually afford to live on Martha's right. Vineyard before the Clintons right. came over and the Obamas, you know, yes. it was a small, yes. beautiful island. Yes. I think Jimmy Cagney lived on the island.
Oh, my gosh.
So we put this, and James Taylor, I'd known James even further back. James had been in a group called The Flying Machine with a guy named Danny Cooch, who was okay. a great guitar player. And they were playing in the same bill we were at the Night Owl. So we got okay. to know James. This is before James
oh
became
God.
James.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of history in all
I
this.
I love it.
So James was on Martha's Vineyard. So we said, all right, well, we'll put a band together there. And that was called the Quinames Band. The Quinames okay. Band was named after a part of the Martha's Vineyard island.
Ah.
So there you go.
All right.
That's the whole long story. And okay. we got signed to Elektra and went on and made absolutely no money or no and had no success. Went back to New York.
It doesn't say anything more about
no,
that.
It should end right there, as a matter of fact. Signed to Elektra Records and was buried under the, you know, statement.
No, it continues to say that at the insistence of ABC Records executives, Palmer joined Steely Dan in an early incarnation in 1972.
Yes, yes.
He sang lead on two tracks on their debut album, Can't Buy a Thrill, Dirty Work, and Brooklyn Owes the Charmer Under Me,
yeah.
as well as doubling parts of Donald Fagen's vocals on Reelin' in the Years, Only a Fool Would Say That, and Change of the Guard to reach the high notes. He also sang lead on most of Steely Dan's songs when performed live in their early concerts.
That is all true.
Okay.
That was all true.
And it says Fagen eventually took over as lead vocalist and Palmer left the band, although he did contribute backing vocals on the band's subsequent release, Countdown to Ecstasy.
Well, it's as glossed over as that is.
Right, right.
Which is
right.
lovely sounding.
Right.
To be perfectly frank about
yes.
this, I had developed a problem with alcohol and drugs.
Okay.
That was to go on for years, but for at least another... Let me see, I got sober in 83, so another 10 years.
Not to make light of it, but no. being in the rock and roll business
yeah.
during the 70s and 80s, shocking.
We used to say
shocking.
We used to say it was built into the budget. Every time we made
cocaine was built into the budget. Every time we made a record, there was like, what's this $10,000 for? For energy. Anyway, it was built into the budget. But that was a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not a friendly drunk.
Okay.
And Donald and Walter and got tired of it.
Yeah.
You know. Number one. Number two is Donald did want to sing. You know, he said this is my
sure
deal, and he was right. By the way, I don't for 1 minute think. You know, I never after I got over the shock of losing my gig. You know, looking back, he was absolutely right. He should have been singing it from the get-go. But you know, I'm also grateful that he didn't. You know, that I got a chance to shoot to sing and go on from there. So that was, I think it was 73 or 74 that happened, and then. Like, it feels like a minute later, Carol Kane called me and said, look, do you want to write? You know, she had, you know, and I said, yeah, I have no pressing engagements, of course.
Right.
So we got together and wrote an album called Wrap Around Joy, and out of that Wrap Around Joy came Jazzman.
Man.
So my success continued, no matter what I tried to do to sabotage it, it continued.
Some people are gifted that way.
It was amazing.
Now, you already covered Jazzman for me. That was the next part in here. And then it says he later formed the band Waku with Danny Duma. Am I saying that right? Yeah, Waku released three albums, The Big Waku in 77, Berkshire in 78, Fragile Line in 79.
Right.
And he also contributed the song Silhouette to the 85 film Teen Wolf.
It's so funny. A friend of mine was a guy who has passed away. It was Miles Goodman. Miles Goodman was a great scorer for movies. He happened to be Johnny Mandel's cousin. If you know anything about music, Johnny Mandel wrote Shadow of Your Smile, theme for MASH.
Okay.
Johnny was a gifted composer and orchestrator.
Okay.
But Miles was his cousin, and Miles got involved in the movie business because of him.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles called me one day. We had written a couple of things. We had written a musical based on the old movie King of Hearts.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever seen it. Alan Bates, I think, was in it. It was an amazing movie.
Mm-hmm.
Geneviève Bourgeois was in it. It's hard to find now, but it was an amazing movie, based on inmates taking over an insane asylum.
Aha,
literally,
well, there you go.
Literally. So we'd written this musical, didn't go anywhere. But Miles knew me, and we and so he got the score for Teen Wolf, and he said, "Would you sing a couple?" And I said, "Sure."
Wow.
So that's probably why I had to get a SAG card. We talked about SAG.
Right.
You know, I did that and a couple other movies, and that's how I got into the union. But anyway, yes, Teen Wolf is somewhere in my legacy, and
every time
you see it, I think it takes place in a closet or something. I can't remember the whole.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit. So you talked about what contributed to you being asked to leave Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And you did talk, you said, you know, the shock of losing the gig. Talk about that, when that happened. What was that like for you?
It was, alcoholics have a tendency to do a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
They get somewhere. They're, whether it be through their talent or their tenacity, and they think they've arrived.
Right.
And I thought I had arrived.
Whatever that means.
But I know.
Yeah.
But what happens is, you know, the problem, they used to say, the problem with arriving if you're a drunk is that you keep bringing you with you everywhere you go when you arrive. And that's exactly what happened. You know, again, it's always self-sabotage in some way, low self-esteem, something goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened to me. I mean, I'm a textbook case.
Okay.
I couldn't stand the success. I couldn't stand the failure. You can't stand anything. You're nuts.
Wow, that's what happened
to me. Okay. And I think over the years, but also I used to say the funniest thing, the worst thing that ever happened was I got the Carol King gig because she recognized my true artistry and Steely Dan didn't.
Oh, of course.
That's the way I thought.
Of course.
And that was, I later found that was total nonsense, but
right.
At the time it made perfect sense to me.
Yep.
And but the problem was, again, once you start on that road, you know, you're there's no coming back from it unless you get help. And I didn't get any help for years. And then finally I did, when everything really fell apart.
Yeah.
So I continued on my merry way, but I, you know, was leaving wreckage everywhere through relationships, through my whatever business I was involved in. You know, it just added up after a while.
Right.
So when 1983 rolled around,
yeah.
I said, I can't keep doing this or I'm going to die. So I got sober.
Were you married during those years?
Yeah, I was married. I'm trying to think. I was with someone
when
the Steely's hit. And then I married someone. That ended, relationship ended. And I married someone, had a child.
Okay.
You know, and it was, you know, but again, it was just,
nothing got between me and my relief from whoever I thought I was.
Sure.
You know, that's sure. what happens to us.
Was there anything that contributed to that? Like, did you understand or have a better grasp of now? Because obviously that shit just doesn't pop up out of nowhere.
I think alcoholics are my opinion, and yeah. it's just my opinion, is that we are just notoriously bad feelers, for one thing. And through it doesn't matter why, whether it's genetic or what it is, but we are predisposed to being allergic to alcohol.
Okay.
That's exactly what I came up with. I realized once I got sober that that was my story. You know, when I took a drink, the world changed.
Right.
Everything got cool. Mm-hmm. Everything got better. But the problem with that, it's the side effects of continuing to drink.
Right.
So when I drank, and the funny thing is, it wouldn't happen to somebody I knew personally. They'd say, "Oh, I've had two drinks, I'm feeling it." I would say, "I have two drinks, I'm gonna get even because I'm feeling it and I'm feeling good and comfortable for the first time in my life."
Wow.
And that's, I think, the difference between me and the average guy on the street, or the guy who can drink socially. I cannot drink socially.
Wow.
So it all added up. And by the time 1983 rolled around, I was out of a gig. I had just gotten a huge deal and blew it. And I was married, and I used to say to a woman who started to hate me because of my behavior, and my child was starting to become afraid of me because you can't predict my behavior.
Of course.
So by the time 1983, I got a DUI. I was driving under the influence. I got arrested, and I got in the drunk tank, and I thought to myself, I got to stop this. I was 36 years old, man, and my life was just going to hell. So I did get some help.
Good.
Everything changed.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Do you still have a relationship with your son, daughter?
My son is in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
He's a lot like me.
Okay.
So he's running wild.
Okay.
They have a saying in Austin, keep Austin weird.
Yes, they do.
And
that's
I'm thinking to myself, and he's doing his best to get to live up to that. he's doing what he can do to contribute to that. You know. So I love him, but you know, there's just he doesn't want any help, and we talk, but it's not a close relationship.
Is he following in your footsteps at all as far as the business
no,
or industry?
No, no. No musical talent that I'm aware of whatsoever. Okay. But basically he keeps it going somehow, and I love him, and that's all I know right
at
this point.
Well, that's extremely important. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about some of the other fun stuff. Some of the fun stuff. So was there any point where you were just like in the middle of it going like, wait a second, I'm this kid from New Jersey. How the hell did I end up here?
Well, which part are you talking about?
Well, I mean, when the success was really, really happening.
It wasn't like it was overnight. You know,
certainly not.
I had worked on it for years. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd been in the various bands. I had done, you know, I had had contracts. I had everything. And actually, ABC had a lot to do with me. But Jeff Baxter was the one who told Fagan about me.
Yeah.
You know, Skunk Baxter said, because I'd known Jeff 100 years ago. And Jeff said, you know, there's this guy in back east who's a good singer, and he could do this. And so he got me the audition to come out.
Right.
And as I drove across country in that Chevelle I had, you know, and just I had notion that anything was going to happen. But I just knew I needed a change. I needed to get out of the East Coast. And and the funniest thing happens when you sat down in front of those speakers when you heard the playbacks of the tracks they had cut.
Right.
And you went, oh my God, I just fell into something so incredible.
Yeah.
Because I'd been with great live bands, but I'd never been with a band that knew how to record.
Really?
And those guys knew how to record.
Now, were you familiar with them before meeting with them?
No, heard of them.
Never heard of them.
No. And they weren't Steely Dan. They hadn't even have the name yet.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was just a group that was forming behind Walter and Donald's writing, basically.
And I mean, I know that you were saying, yes, it was built up over a number of years. It didn't happen overnight, but at the same time, how many garage bands or basement bands start with,
hardly any.
Everyone has the aspiration of like, we're going to be rock stars.
Yeah.
How many of them actually make it?
No.
So that's why I'm asking, did you have that moment of like, holy crap?
Yeah, I did. And it happened in front of the speakers when I sat down. And there was a recording studio in LA called Village Recorders, which is in West Los Angeles, still there. And I sat down in front of the speakers. They started just playing me back tracks.
Right.
Holy crap. You know, they had cut Reeling in the Years.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Randall had played that amazing guitar solo. Mm-hmm. Jeff played great stuff. They had started cutting. They hadn't cut Do It Again. They had Reeling in the Years, I think, was the first thing I heard. And Kings. They had cut both of those songs. And I heard those songs. This is for the first album, for those who are listening out there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I thought, oh my God. You know, and they hadn't cut Dirty Work yet. And they wanted a different approach on Dirty Work, which thank God they did,
right?
Which I was able to bring. Yes, it was a It was absolutely a moment of clarity. Was going, oh my God, I finally got what I want.
Right.
You know.
So, right.
Yeah.
Now, who the hell told you you could sing in the first place? How did that all happen?
The choir director at the Methodist Youth Choir. In Union Village, New Jersey.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I was a boy soprano. I mean, she heard my voice. She said, "Oh my God," you know. So yeah, I had that knocked from the get-go. I loved singing, you know, at the time, continue to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, your voice was, you know, of course, going back and listening to it again, you know, in preparation for sitting down and talking with you, I was like, oh my God, listen to that. I mean, I know you now,
right,
this way, as the way. Gentleman that you are now, and I'm going, with all due respect, I'm going, how is that possible?
Yeah.
How is that possible? Now, I'm going to ask you a stupid question.
Go ahead.
Can you still sing like that?
No.
And are you a little unnerved? Like you're like, damn it.
I can reach the notes.
Yeah.
And I could probably do it. But again, it's like anything else, whether you're an actor or an artist, or if you don't do it.
Right.
And it's your gift, especially harder for singers, mm-hmm. because it's such a muscle involved deal.
Right.
Muscle memory deal. Mm-hmm. That if you don't do it continually, you start to lose the range. You start to lose the power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's pretty much what's happened to me. Although as a matter of fact, I did sing Dirty Work in some kind of situation in Los Angeles, and I could still feel that I still had the power. I can still.
Nice.
And I sang backgrounds on Steve Tyrell's last, a couple albums ago on mm-hmm. Jazzman. So I knew I had, I still have it.
Right.
But it takes such control.
I mean, what you did, and just, again, listening to the songs that you did at that time, you know, people referred to you that way, even Reddit, it was very angelic.
Yeah. I don't know.
Where did that come from? Anybody in your family, singers?
My mom was a big opera fan, but there was no singers that I'm aware of in our family. I just had a gift, you know,
yep.
and, you know, not many people do. And it was an amazing gift later on, too. I mean, I continued. I'll have to give you some of my demos that I recorded long after. My voice started to change in a way that was less angelic, which was fine with me. You know, it's so funny. I had that gift. But I really wanted to be Otis Redding.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Or I wanted to be Wilson Pickett.
Right.
Or I wanted to be those old-time R&B guys. I didn't want to be David Palmer, angelic voice. You know, but that's what God gave me, and that's what that's the success that came.
But that's always the way, isn't it? The grass is always greener, because, I mean, I'm sure I can list a lot of people who would be like, man, I'd love to sing like David Palmer did.
I know. It is true.
Yeah.
You know, when it happens, you're not realizing. In my case, I didn't realize how grateful I should have been that. That's what propelled it, you know, but I didn't. So
that the curse of youth,
arrogance of some, you know.
You know, the whole youth is wasted on the young.
21 bulletproof, never gonna lose it. You know,
sure, kind of, sure. Stuff. More with David Palmer in just a minute. You're listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network, and they're adding new ones all the time, showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. Shoutouts: David Friels for the Jason Laughlin interview. He was a good friend of Jason's dad, Terry Laughlin, who passed away a few years ago. Terry was a wonderful actor who appeared in countless movies and TV shows. I hate that I never had the chance to interview him for the podcast, but I did have the pleasure of working with him on stage as a director and acting coach for many years. Thank you, David, for the email and for listening. David Price sent an email saying, "Rave review! I love rave reviews!" He emailed to tell me how much he enjoyed the Scott Thomas interview. I love the Scott Thomas interview. Still one of my all-time favorites. As well as the Lee Spencer interview. Lee Spencer is pretty freaking cool. I agree. Thank you so much to the Davids for taking the time to sit down and write an email. Amazing. I'm humbled. I'm at a loss for words. It's the best. And this song? Another David Palmer original. Go to his website and check it out. DavidPalmerImages.com and click on the Lost Demos. All right. More with David Palmer. Jeez, another David. I'm up to my ass in David's today. Now, I got to ask you about that big, giant mop of hair you had. I mean, man, that was a mop of hair.
That was a lot of hair.
Those old photos and videos are great to see.
Curl, yeah, in some ways. Some ways they're great to
great
see.
Great for me to see.
Yeah, for your audience that aren't mm-hmm. familiar, yeah, I had hair down in my, almost in my butt, and it was curly, and it was long, and it was like, you know, it was rock and roll.
Yeah, man.
But, you know, that has since gone the way of older people, I guess.
Time is a cruel thing.
Time is cruel. It's funny, my girl,
Julie wants me to grow. She said, "Yeah, grow your hair back." I said, "Not on your life." Not. She doesn't want that.
Right.
She wanted to be. I said, "No, I like being clean and tight."
Yeah. Right. So we do. We do have this wonderful dear friend in common.
Mm-hmm.
Our good friend Julie Cobb, who I have interviewed here on the show before.
Right.
So how did that come about?
I was married successfully, mm-hmm. had a great marriage, and my wife passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And after she died, I thought, I was in my 60s. I said, I'm never going to do that again. And a friend of mine called and said, look, I have a friend, and she's hasn't been in a relationship a long time. She's looking, she maybe wants a date. And I said, I was so arrogant. He said, you want to go on a blind date? And it was the old Buck Henry line. Do I have to stick needles in my eyes? Blind date. I haven't been on a blind date since I was 18.
Right.
So I said, okay. I said, look, it was about 8 months after Susan passed away. And so, and then he said, and you can Google her.
You can Google her.
And I said, well, she can Google me.
Oh, jeez. There's the rock star.
And neither of us Googled it. I don't know. But she walked into the restaurant, and I said, holy Jesus, she was so beautiful, and she was just amazing. And we just, right from the get-go, we hit it off. It was, I don't know how that happened. She's an actress, mm-hmm. came from that whole, anybody knows that her dad was Lee J. Cobb.
Right.
She came from that situation comedy, a lot of episodic television.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like a singer, we used to talk. She never participated in the 60s. Like I did.
Right.
To explain that. She went to San Francisco State and never got high. It was like,
oh my gosh,
she didn't smoke grass. I was like, honey, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
So we came from very desperate backgrounds, And yet we hit it off. She made me laugh, and I think I made her laugh, and it was just great, and it was really cool.
And I would think, though, but drugs aside and that whole lifestyle aside.
Yeah.
I would think that there's still a great deal of things that you two would have connected on in a very similar way, even you being in the music business and her being an actress, that there are some very strong parallels.
Of course, sure. Of course, artistic. We're both artistic. We're very oriented that way.
Sure.
Of course, there were. I don't mean to.
Right.
In a way, it was amazing. So, yeah. And we were together for basically on for 3 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got a call that she wanted, that her daughter was moving to Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I missed my daughter. I want to be in Charlotte. And I said, good luck. The last thing I am ever going to do is move to Charlotte, North Carolina. We left it that way.
Yes.
And we were apart for about a year.
Right.
And I missed her so badly. I just said, all right. I'm willing to, can I come and just check it out?
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I came, I was not a successful checkout.
I thought,
first I hated nine streets in one.
I was
getting lost all the time.
Sure.
And I went to Asheville and did some work and came back. Then I went back to LA. And 6 months later, I said, let's try it again. So I moved. I came back here and I loved it. I fell in love with it.
Excellent. Well, we're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay, so now, do you play as well as sing?
I play piano when I was writing. I have, again, I don't have the instrument mic. I just stopped all of that. People would say, don't you miss it? And I have a different creative art form now.
You do. The demos that you're talking about, is that the stuff that's on your website?
Yes.
Yeah, I listened to a bunch of those. I wasn't able to get through all of them.
Yeah.
And I certainly heard how your voice has got a little more gravel and
gravel
rasp to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still sounds great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, they also had a very, I'm going to take a stab here, 80s, early 90s? Is that when you did those?
Yeah, basically 90s. When you would record with probably a drum machine and a lot of synths.
Yep.
Which is not obviously what they do now, but
sure.
At the time, it's what was, and that's how I was able to get a record deal. A publishing deal,
mm-hmm.
and they were just basically demos. It's funny. I go back and listen to them now, and I know they sound dated, but I also know that there's still a melody.
Absolutely,
the chord changes are still good.
Yeah.
So it's just the sound itself was very different.
Yeah. Oh, it was very, very different. Right.
Yeah.
But I was like, this is. I just kept going to the next one and the next one and the next one. No, I thought they were great, but I was like, oh yeah, I wonder if he did these back around that time.
I did. It was about I'm gonna say late '80s, early '90s.
And they had a very motion picture-y sound to them as well.
Yeah, I was. It was cinematic to a certain degree.
Yeah,
yeah, I think so too. It's so funny because I some of those were written with a guy named Snuffy Walden, let me explain who Snuffy Walden is. Snuffy Walden went on to be this main score for 30 something, and went on from there to do the Wonder Years,
the theme from The West Wing,
and then he went to do West Wing.
So that theme song.
That's Snuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's,
he's got some talent.
He's amazing.
Jeez.
We're still friends today, but it was amazing that, you know, we were both looking for an avenue for our music.
Right.
You know? Some of the stuff I wrote by myself, but Snuffy wrote some great stuff too. So we were basically hooked up. There's a great new documentary about him that's out, but I don't think it's on Netflix yet.
Okay.
It's something called Up to Snuff. And if anybody gets a chance to see it, please go see it.
I want
to
say that maybe I saw the trailer for it or something.
You might have.
Like that.
It was on YouTube. It was okay. YouTube or Facebook,
yeah,
or something.
Something like that.
They always are.
Yeah.
You know,
it sounds great.
Yeah.
So I'm sure when you talk to people who find out what your background is, they all want to hear the stories. I certainly want to hear the stories. Do you enjoy telling the stories?
I don't mind.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you know, what I used to, you know, to be perfectly honest, again, is my background now I use to try to advance my art.
Right.
When they find out I was in Steely Dan, it's always an addition to what I do now, and it's always a right. great promotional tool. And it's like, yeah, that's what I did. This is what I do now,
mm-hmm.
and I used that a little bit, you know, not as much. I used to get very uptight about it. Oh, I'm a photographer now. I outgrew that phase. It's like, if I could promote my art through the fact that I was in Steely, fine,
yep.
let it play out, or that I wrote with Carol, fine, let mm-hmm. it play out.
Yep.
It's fine with me. Yeah.
So, okay, so let's get to it then, since you brought it up. So you've made the transition.
See what I did there?
Oh, you're a pro. This is not your first time at the rodeo, pal, I can tell. So now, yes, you are a photographer. Your art is photography. So
yes.
That's an understandable yet interesting transition from music.
What happened was I was in my 40s somewhere.
Okay.
And I felt like I didn't know anything about the music business anymore. Mm-hmm. Certainly, and it's so much a business and less music for me that I just said, I can't do this anymore. I don't find any artistic fulfillment. Plus, I had writer's block. I was sitting down at the keyboards. I couldn't write anything.
Wow.
No lyric came. It was like all ridiculous stuff. And so I just said, God, I got to get away from this. So I don't know why. I picked up a little camera, a little digital camera, and I started to take shots and do panoramics and mm-hmm. get a little involved in it. And I thought, I love this. You know, I love sitting at a computer and working right. with Photoshop and making images. I love all of that. And it became my passion. And I slowly slipped right out of music into that.
Wow.
It was an amazing process, and the fact that I didn't look back
right.
and go, oh God, I wish I was, you know, I didn't have any regrets. You know, it's sort of like moving from Los Angeles to Charlotte. People said, did you notice a huge difference? And I said, no, I was ready.
Wow.
I was,
well, there you go.
I was tired of the freeways. I was tired of burning trees. I was tired of the earthquake. I was tired of all of it. I've been at this since 1972.
Wow.
And so I was done. Yeah. And so there was no big transition to move to Charlotte, you know. And I found great stuff in Charlotte, new stuff, a great artistic community. Which and largely through Julie. I mean, Julie introduced me to a lot of people.
Right, and you know, I actually appreciate you saying that.
Yeah,
really
no, do. It is. It's a vibrant. It's a vibrant community.
Really great to hear.
So, the same thing happened in my transition from music into photography. And somebody asked me, "What's the difference?" I said, "Well, first of all, I don't have to ask the band what they think."
Right.
That's a big plus right there. That's an amazing thing, right?
Oh my gosh!
So I'm being facetious, but still,
right.
It was, and slowly over a period of time, I started to, you know, I did the usual photography things. I shot weddings, I shot portraits, I shot, you know, headshots, and all of a sudden, I discovered somebody's work, a guy named Joel Grimes, who is an amazing photographer, but he had a way of doing his work that involved compositing. And compositing was shooting backgrounds first and then shooting people in his studio or a different look and compositing them into a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, the sound of it was like, oh, it's just so manual. And then I saw his work. And I thought, this guy knows what he's doing to the point where it's become a different art form. And I started to do compositing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I was able to you know, I start, that became my art form.
Yep.
And anybody goes to my website will see it. You know, it's transitioned over a period of years. I was not good at it in the beginning, and I got better and better and better.
Sure.
Just it became a passion for me, and I had some success with it in Beverly Hills. And again, that's when people said, well, you mind if we use Steely Dan? I said, no, use it all you want. I don't care about that. As long as the focus is on my art now, I don't care.
Right.
You know, over a period of years, again, I've discovered the form. It's almost like magical realism. If you know, it's that kind of, if you equate it to anything literary, mm-hmm. to me, that's what it's become. And I've just pursued that form and continue to do it.
Give you a shameless plug. It's davidpalmerimages.com.
Thank you.
If you want to go and check it out, there's a lot of great stuff on there. I can attest I have now worked personally with David, which was an unbelievable gift and treat to be able to do that. Because his work is really spectacular, and I don't know what else to say except unexpected. Like when you sent the proofs and printed out the images, I was truly just blown away. It was not at all what I was expecting, and I had already looked at your work, and I still was like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, I love working with you guys. You guys are great.
Thank you.
I'm just for those of you who don't know, they just did Brian and Mark just did The Odd Couple. And it was great to work with you guys because I said, how am I going to do that? And I, as a matter of fact, my girlfriend had the idea of saying, why don't we just do like an American Gothic with these guys?
Which was awesome.
It's exactly what we
did.
And they were great together. Yeah. When I'm shooting and I have my makeup person there and maybe I ask what other people think. What do you think about this? Or what do you think? I'm not so enamored of my own opinion that I can't. Mm-hmm. Get other people's input. I just work with Mandy Murrow Brown, okay. who you may know, but she's a great makeup person,
okay.
and she came in and just gave her input, and I was so open to it. If you start to shut down to other people's opinions, you get really, really paralyzed in a way.
Certainly.
With your own opinion.
Right.
So anyway, I opened it up. And Julie had the idea about you doing American Gothic with you guys, and it came out great.
Yeah, it really, really did. So is your work then similar to a painter, where you're just going to sit down basically in front of or with the camera and create whatever comes about? Or are you getting commissioned for things, or are people coming to you?
Not yet. I mean, I've had that suggested to me, mm-hmm. but I'm so fortunate. A lot of artists have got to do what's the next indicated step in terms of making a living.
Right.
And because of my background and what I've succeeded at before, I don't have to do that. I'm creating images for myself. Mm-hmm. If other people like them, fantastic.
Right.
You know, when I work with you guys, it was like I knew kind of what I wanted to do, but I also knew, you know, that it was a gift, you know, to you guys. I didn't have to make a living at it. So I think to make a long story even longer,
make it as long as you want.
My images are I just got done doing a session on Vietnam images. I was in Vietnam about a year and a half ago shooting. I have a friend who has an organization called Global Wheels.
Right.
He brings wheelchairs to third world countries. He's an old friend of mine, and he does it in a way that's got integrity and class. It's not like here's a plastic wheelchair. You know, he actually goes over, fits people to wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. Does this amazing work.
Wow.
But it's funny because you have to cooperate with the communist government. You just can't go in there. You know, and Vietnam is a communist
right.
country, so there are stipulations and stuff. But he called me. He said, "Look, I had been with him 9 years ago. We went to South Vietnam, went to Saigon, and he said, well, I'm going to Hanoi. Would you like to go to Hanoi?" And I said, "In a heartbeat." So he paid for my way. He didn't pay me. You know, it was a gratis deal,
sure.
And I got to wander around 5:30 in the morning in Hanoi. Now, you have to understand, I'm not sure if it's the Chinese or who's coming, but motor scooters run that country.
Really?
There are no stop signs,
no
stop lights. You take your life. So I got to wander around Hanoi, and I shot these incredible backgrounds. I came back to the States, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And I ran into somebody in Charlotte who is Vietnamese, beautiful woman. So we ended up shooting her in my studio, and I'm incorporating her into my background.
Really?
As we speak, yeah. So I'll send you some of the stuff. It came out amazingly well.
I can't.
My next thing, my next project is to shoot. I want to shoot a dancer in Charlotte. I want to shoot. There's a wonderful ballet company here.
Absolutely, the North Carolina Dance Theater.
Yeah, and there's a woman who I've seen and who I haven't been in touch with yet, but I think I want to shoot her and use Charlotte backgrounds.
And that's what I'm in the process of doing now. I know, you know, it's hard to explain what I do without it sounding hokey. That's why you have to look at it.
You absolutely
then
have
to say
it.
this is what works and what this is why he's doing what he's doing. I'm never out of ideas. You know, I'm always
that's the best part, I think.
That's what I love about this thing. I've never run dry when it comes to images.
You spent some time in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Is there any was there any effect or connection to you between going there and visiting not too long ago to you actually living through that era where Vietnam was such a prevalent subject?
You know, it's
subject.
A funny thing. I've been asked that question before. The Vietnamese people are so resilient and so amazingly. I was standing in the corner one day and I watched a scooter go by, and a guy had tied a refrigerator on the back of his scooter and had bungeed it. It was the most astonishing thing. People are amazingly imaginative and smart and clever, and you know, and they hold. I couldn't sense any animus toward America. Mm-hmm. None. As a matter of fact, I would go to pay for things. The dong is their currency.
Yeah.
And I'd whip my, no, we don't. We would like American dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel any hangover from the war. You know. There's a museum there, though, however, that's scary as hell, which is the museum, the War Museum.
I can't even imagine.
And it has nothing to do with American propaganda. Right. It has to do with what the Vietnamese people went through.
Exactly.
Tunnels. And, and scary as heck.
Because when I think about, you know, that time period when it was the magical heyday time of David Palmer as a musician, at least on paper, I can't help but think of the movie Almost Famous. And that's what I kind of like.
It's a great movie.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, was it like...
I have a story.
Tell me a story.
So there's a famous nightclub in Los Angeles called the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Oh, yeah.
Which a lot of groups came out of. A lot of people played there when they came to L.A. So we went back. This is going to be in the 71 or 72, 73, somewhere in there. 72, I guess. Anyway, we went back and we're going to play the Whiskey with Steely. So we got on stage. We did our set. And we got off stage, and I went upstairs to the dressing room, and there's this kid sitting there. I mean, you know, he looked 10.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a notebook and a piece and a pencil in his hand. I said, what are you? He said, I'm here to interview the band. I said, what, for a college paper or something? He said, no, my name's Cameron Crowe.
Oh, my God.
And I'm running for Rolling Stone.
Oh, my God.
And I thought
God.
To myself, what, are they signing teenagers up to be their writers now?
Wow.
Yeah, that was an amazing story.
Wow.
So there was Cameron Crowe, who for your audience doesn't know, went on to write Almost Famous.
Exactly. About his time.
About his time.
As a teenager writing for
Rolling Stone. That's a great old story about rock and roll.
God, that's nuts.
Yeah, he was, Almost Famous has got it right. You know, they got it right. It was amazing.
I mean, was your experience
similar? Yeah, similar. Steely was never like a Led Zeppelin kind of.
Right.
We didn't pull the women, as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, that was not the deal. It was about Donald. Although, it's so funny because I was hired to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was hired to be the front man. And,
right.
You know, and it was incongruous in a way that I was up on stage with those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was like the lead singer.
Right.
And they didn't want the lead singer. There was a band going
on.
So that was another reason I wasn't going to last long in that environment, because you know, they didn't want that image.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted an image that was more of what their music was about, and you know, much more advanced than most of the rock and roll.
And their music style was a little different than a lot. Yeah. So I mean, what were they really considered to fall under more? Yes, rock and roll, but...
But, no, I mean, they were so jazz-influenced, and they were so knowledgeable. I mean, you know that word rock, genius is thrown a lot in the music business.
Sure.
My take is, there's Dylan,
mm-hmm.
then there's Walter and Donald, and maybe a couple other guys, because that's it, as far as intelligence and in the music.
Really?
They were so smart.
Yeah.
And the music was, it reflected that. Okay. I mean, it was about that. Dylan from a different way. I mean, obviously, but you know, it's a word that's bandied around. I see, he's the new genius. And then, oh, come on, you know.
And talk to me if you can about what it was like collaborating with Carole King.
It was amazing. I mean, I've known Carole for a lot of years. You know, I knew her before Tapestry, and I cannot even fathom that kind of success. And that was just off the charts, and it continued to be.
I was very grateful. She called me. By that time, I was I wanted an outlet for my writing, and she gave it to me. You know, and I knew an entire, again, everybody saw Carol as like the Earth Mother kind of
sure.
thing. I knew her as a 24-year-old girl from Brooklyn, for God's sake. She was just a, you know, she and Jerry were just kids. Mm-hmm. And when all that success happened for them, and when they produced us, you know, mm-hmm. it was just a different idea of what that was all about. But Carol was great. The way Carol worked was that you would write a lyric and give it to her, and then she would do the music. Now, when she was doing her own stuff, I think it was a combination that, you know, when she was writing her own songs, like You Got a Friend, and that,
right.
it was a different deal. But I would give her a lyric, and she'd come back with a song. You know, this was quite a collaboration. I'd also collaborated, when I was in Boston, I was going to school in Boston, we had written together too. She had a band called The City, okay. which never went anywhere, mm-hmm. but that was, you know, we had written a couple songs for that. So I knew kind of how she wrote, I knew what to expect. But again, Jazzman was perfect timing.
Sure.
Know? Just, and then a lot of the success anybody has in that business is timing.
Right.
And what that timing is, I couldn't possibly explain.
Of course. I don't think that there is an X factor or some explanation. No. I think it's just stars happens. Lining up.
Yep, somehow.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Do you ever look back now and just think, did that really happen? Is it ever dreamlike in any way to you?
No.
No?
I don't think so. It was a reality. I don't look at in a romantic way. I am much more grateful at my age now mm-hmm. than I was when it was happening.
Sure.
And, you know, that for whatever reason, sense. I never look back and say, well, why did that happen? It just did.
What is it about music that just makes people go so crazy? What do you think?
You know, I've never really entertained that question a whole lot because I was in it. I just loved music. I just loved lyric. I loved melodies. That's my take on it. And why it has almost a visceral connection to people, I don't get. It's like talking to people now, you know, when they find out what my background is. Well, that right. must have been, you know. Yeah, it was great. Mm-hmm. And I am kind of more interested in other people's reaction and why they react the way they do. But I think it's changed, too. I don't know about a new generation involved with music. I'm sure it's still there.
Maybe.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed in just a little bit of dabbling on an amateur level that I've done with music is that it just seems like, man, if you're a musician, I'm a musician, it doesn't matter if we agree on anything else.
Yeah.
We can sit down and play together.
That's true.
And then there's an instant or automatic bond that happens to anyone who listens to, plays, appreciates, sings music of any kind. Like, it doesn't even, you can be into rock, I can be into country or hip hop or whatever, and I mean, we can all just go, wow, that's yeah. really great.
Yeah, it's so funny. I became a huge fan of Brandi Carlile because of that huge hit she had. The Joke. But I thought, and it reminded me so much of the writing that was done in my generation. Mm-hmm. There was something so incredibly moving about that writing lyrically,
right?
The way she lined up her phrasing and the way she used that chorus that's what I was raised on, is the sure. way to write songs,
right?
And it's funny because I was listening to Billie Eilish the other day, and I think she's great.
Yeah,
I think she's an amazing talent, and people my age don't get it, but I do. I think she comes from a a legacy of songwriting.
Right.
And she just got it. Mm-hmm. Whatever you may think of her, she understands how to write songs. You know, it gives me hope.
Absolutely.
When I listen to that and when I listen to Brandi, I got hope that the songwriting will carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly been guilty of, you know, even myself, of sitting there listening to things and going like, they don't write songs like they used to. They don't make music like they used to.
My friend of mine used to say, "Why you're turning into your parents?"
But I think it's the music. Yes. But it's the music that forms us during those formative years that's so influential. Like I'm still never happier unless I'm listening to people like James Taylor or sure. Springsteen or Journey. All those songs, even Manilow.
Yeah.
At times.
At times.
And I'm like, well, where's the Barry Manilow of today? You know?
I don't think I've ever said that. But but I have said, you know, there's a tradition from Dylan to Donald and Walter to Bruce to, you know, that
right.
you know,
right.
there are artists now who are doing it. You know, like mm-hmm. I said, I have great hope for the future.
Well, look, David, I am so incredibly grateful of the friendship that I now have with you, which was completely unexpected and out of left field and the blue. And I'm so grateful for you taking the time to
come and sit down.
I can't
wait to hear the edited version of this.
I'm excited about it already, and I don't know how much editing I'm going to do.
Well, it's got to be done, especially the coughing
really, that's the best part. Seriously, go check out his website, davidpalmerimages.com. His work is amazing. He's amazing. David, thank you so much again.
Thanks, bro.
This has been You May Have Seen with David Palmer. Thanks so much for listening. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout-out in the next episode. My strength is gone, but I keep holding on.